Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome back to Saints and Witches. My cat is trying to drink my coffee.
Good old Frank.
Special kitty. I tell him every day how special he is. So I got him this like maize feeder thing, you know, because he is such a chunk that he eats so fast.
He has a tunnel feeder. So
yeah. He eats so fast that he vomits, and then he eats his own vomit. It's fun.
That's my boy.
Yep. Very special. And so.
And it means I don't have to clean up the floor.
True. Very true. So this feeder is just like super cheap, like plastic. I'm sure it was like made in China, like for 99 cents. And he has the hardest time with it. And it's like really heartbreaking to watch because he simply cannot get the food out. Like it takes him a really long time, which is the point of it. But I feel bad. And so I'll go check in on him while he's eating. And I'll like pick a piece of food out and put it on the floor so he can eat it. And he just looks at me like, am I a joke to you?
I've started taking the tubes out of Hannibal's feeder and hiding them around the house, which he is immensely pleased by because he thinks that there's secret extra food hidden in the house. It's like, no, it's the same amount of food. It's just all over the place.
Oh, God bless them. They're so special.
Yes.
Yes. we have new listeners in Spain. So, hola. Nuevos amigos, bienvenidos.
I don't speak Spanish.
Me neither. I just have vague memories of Spanish in high school.
I remember how to say carrots.
Zanahorias.
Yep.
That's the fun one. If you have not listened to this podcast before, welcome. I'm Sarah. I'm a Catholic.
I'm Liz, and I'm a witch.
And we're friends. And we get together on a very strict schedule to tell each other stories about saints and witches.
A schedule that we bend more and more every week.
Shh, don't tell them our secrets. They don't need
behind
to know.
The scenes, we're a shit show.
Well, that seems pretty obvious.
Yeah, if you've listened to any episode before this, yeah.
Yeah. Should we get into it?
I don't think I opened my story talking about where we are today. So.
Oh, shit. Okay. Where are we today?
Scotland.
Scotland.
Again. We're in Scotland again.
What do they say in Scotland? What's a Scottish phrase that I can throw in?
What's a stereotypical Scottish phrase that Sarah can be ridiculed for?
What's the one? All I can think of is like pirate speak, but that's not how they talk.
And all I can think of is Shrek. So.
Why? That's true. Why is Shrek randomly Scottish?
I have no idea.
In the make-believe world of Shrek, the universe, why is Shrek a Scottish man, Scottish ogre man.
I don't know.
It's a mystery.
Anyway. Fuck. I make a reference to an old episode and I didn't realize how long ago it was. And it made me realize how far we are in now. And it fucked with me. Pandemic is screwed with like my sense of time. I don't know how we got through all of these episodes.
Me neither.
We were on episode 5 and now we're on episode 30 and I don't know what happened in between there other than werewolves.
There were some werewolves. There was a lot of urine, I think.
There was quite a bit of urine.
Peeing everywhere. There was that one lady who peed outside her house or whatever. What was her name? So that was like the Denmark lady, I think. She peed on somebody's lawn. And yeah. They were like, we will murder you because of that. Enough urine.
Enough urine talk. So I decided today I wanted to circle around to a set of trials I've mentioned about half a dozen times over the last year that we've been recording. But I've never featured this set of trials. Mm-hmm. And those trials would be the North Berwick with a W. You figure out where the W's at. Trials of 1590, which do not take place in North Berwick, Scotland.
Oh, fun.
The trials get their name from a church in North Berwick that this group of witches was said to gather at.
Okay.
So hold on to your ass, I guess, as we dive into regicide, miraculous healings, bewitching a cow to fall in love with you, and a dick measuring contest that killed a whole bunch of people.
Sounds like James, King James territory.
Oh, you guessed it.
I talk about him a lot, too. This is going to be like the King James episode.
Remember those t-shirts we're going to make. King James is a cunt.
King James is a cunt. And I stand by that.
Fight me. I'll die on that hill.
Yeah.
Sidebar for our listeners. I'm not going to talk about witchcraft in Scotland much today as like a concept. So if you want to know more about witchcraft beliefs in Scotland, the Great Scottish Witch Hunts, their witchcraft acts, I would head back to episode 8, Scotland, Are You Okay? And that's where I wrote the note that I said, holy shit, I did not realize that episode was so long ago.
Yeah, forever ago.
I thought for sure that episode was in the teens. It is not.
I don't want to keep interrupting, but it's like going on a year that I have been engaged. And I remember we recorded that episode the day after.
Dude, wild.
Okay, I'm ready.
I mess with my perception of time even more.
Sorry.
That's okay. Today's story begins in late 1589 with 23-year-old James I, who is not James I right now because it will be 14 years before he's King of England. Mm-hmm. But I'm used to calling him James I. Right now, in all technicality, he's James the 6th King of Scotland, but for the purposes of this story, James I or James.
Okay.
In August 1589, James proxy marries Princess Anne of Denmark. And I didn't write it down. Why don't I write this shit down? Proxy marries essentially just whenever two people get married, but one of the people isn't present.
What? How is that legal?
It's essentially like if there you can't make it because of travel or maybe there's like a war or something going on that like you can't get them together in the same place.
I guess they did have like other concerns in like the Middle Ages. I was like, why can't you show up to your fucking wedding? Like, that's so like so typical.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
so he proxy marries Princess Anne of Denmark, but the weather on the seas, like I said, reasons that they can't get like together in person. One of those reasons is that the weather on the seas is terrible at this point. And it's so terrible that after the proxy marriage, Anne tries to sail to James in Scotland, but she can't make it. The seas are just too bad. She ends up in Norway and tries to sail from there twice, but still cannot make it to Scotland. The storms are just horrible. The ship carrying the couple's wedding gifts sinks at one point, which kills like 40 people.
Shit.
Yeah. And I love the fact that when I read the sentence, it starts out with like, oh no, like the wedding gifts. And then it ends with like also 40 people.
Maybe like, some of the people diaries. Were wedding gifts.
One of them was supposed to be a lady in waiting too, Anne.
That's sad.
Yeah. So many people died. And in October 1589, James makes up his mind to go fetch Anne. Like himself, like he's like, hey, she can't make it to me. I'm just gonna go fucking get her, I guess. He leaves his cousin, the Earl of Bothwell, in charge of Scotland, and he sails to Anne in Norway. They marry officially in person, stay in Denmark for several months, and then on April 21st, 1590, head for Scotland, docking on the 1st of May, which I find cool because that's like this week. These days, but like 431 years ago.
I love that.
Yeah, that's it was really interesting when I ran across that. Mm-hmm. And when, again, my perception of time, whenever I calculated that as being 431 years ago, I had an existential crisis. I don't know why I thought the 1500s was like 200 years ago. But it's not.
We are in the Enlightenment age. Yeah. But,
like, isn't 431 it so scary? Is so specific. I'm like, people were having whole ass lives like 500 years ago. That's so crazy to me.
Yeah. And now they are dead in the ground. And someday we will be those people who are dead in the ground. Like, I can't. It's too early to think about that.
And I will be at a point in time that somebody looks back on in the future and goes, 431 years ago. And it's like, oof,
spooky. Spooky.
I don't like it.
Scary bad.
That's a thought for 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not 9 a.m. We have to have a, like, a day still. So mm-hmm. Let's cut the shit.
Put that in the back of my mind. Stow it for now. Mm-hmm. I have mentioned this story in summary a million times at this point, the whole the sea storms get blamed on witches thing.
Yeah.
And all of this I knew previously because I run into it so many times reading about James the First. I ran across this new bit of info from one source that made me sigh so hard. I'm surprised the complete lack of oxygen should just kill me right Whoa. Then and there. The source says in regard to the trip that Anne had tried to make to Scotland from Denmark, that the admiral of the Danish Royal Navy reported that the reason they didn't make it was that the ships were in like a really poor state. They were in poor condition, poor repair. Mm-hmm. Well, he is in like this dick measuring contest. The article says it's a feud. I call it a dick measuring contest.
Sure.
With the governor of Copenhagen, who's in charge of the money, being the governor of Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And essentially, whenever the governor hears this jab that our ships were too shitty for the future queen because you won't pay to make them better, he throws back, no, that's not why the ships didn't make it. The ships didn't make it because witchcraft.
Like, oh, duh. Of course. Duh. Yeah. Everybody knows that.
It's not my fault. Like, it was witches.
Everybody knows that, like, the primary goal of witches is just to like mess around with like transportation.
Yep. They just really fucking hate cargo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fuck that cargo.
It's part of our mission statement. You know, the ship in the Suez Canal, that was us.
I actually believe that. Like, I would totally buy that.
Anywho. Just, why, like, at any point they could have come to an agreement, but they didn't, and they just decided to do this instead. And so, because of this whole stupid it was witches who caused the storm bullshit, a trial starts up in Copenhagen in 1590 under the rule of Christian the Fourth, who is Anne's brother. Okay. I have mentioned him before back in our Denmark episode, and his witchcraft act. The Copenhagen trial is another trial I will eventually circle back to someday. It's in April 1590, and by November 1590, we have the start of the North Berwick trials in Trinant, which is in southeastern Scotland, just outside Edinburgh.
Okay.
Trinant is like 20 minutes from North Berwick, so they're all very close,
mm-hmm.
and they're on like this coast of this harbor. Anyway, initially, so far as my research told me, the North Berwick trials have nothing to do with James the First or finding the culprit behind the sea storms. Eventually they will, but not at the start. James is simply just aware that these trials are taking place as the king. So this is very much just kind of like this localized little witch hunt that eventually gets connected to him and he becomes involved in.
Okay.
I'm going to be talking about three accused witches from the North Berwick trials today, but I will be hopping around chronologically, so be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
The trials start with Gaelus Duncan, or Gilly Duncan, which I love.
Gilly. Isn't that the name of that Kristen Wiig character on SNL?
Gilly. Galus is an uneducated maidservant to magistrate slash deputy bailiff slash known witch hunter David Seton or Seton or Smeaton in some records. His name varies. This is a man who is struggling financially around this point and is convinced someone is working witchcraft against him. Because, again, like, why is it witches, dude? Like, maybe you just suck at filling out your checkbook. Like, take some responsibility.
Can't be that. Cannot be that.
Mm-mm. No, I am not rich, therefore witchcraft.
Flawless
logic. Put it on my grave.
I am not rich, therefore witchcraft on your grave. Everybody's like, what the fuck? What is he talking about?
No one knows.
A crazy old man.
Did I ever tell you that my goal when I die is to be like the haunted grave that everybody in town comes and drinks at like 2 a.m?
The one that teenagers have sex on.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that's what I want to be. So I'm trying to figure out what to put on my gravestone to make sure that that happens.
Or maybe can it literally
the right plot?
Right. Or can it literally just say witch?
I don't know, because I don't want my body to be like dug up and burned because I'm going to be buried in my hometown. It's really Christian and really conservative. Yeah. So it's a fine line to walk there.
Yeah. We'll figure it out. We'll make sure that
I've got some time to piece it together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if I die unexpectedly, you best be telling my family you got to put something spooky shit on her gravestone because this is what she wanted.
I will be the first one to have sex on your gravestone. I promise you that.
Just break it in.
Ew, break it in. Gross.
Did you know that graves are only like 1.5 feet underneath the dirt?
Oh, so you'll hear everything.
Yeah, they only legally have to have like 18 inches of soil on top of them. So dead bodies are not as far under your feet as you think.
That's disgusting, but also beautiful.
Yeah, so think about that when you have sex on my grave.
What are we even talking about?
I don't know.
I don't know, but I'm horny. Just kidding.
David Seton, his finances, thinks that it's witchcraft, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In November of 1590, David, Gilly's employer, gets upset that she's sneaking out of the house at night, but he's more disturbed that even though she's a maid and she's uneducated, that somehow she's become like this popular healer in the community. Mm. Like, it doesn't add up in his mind. He's like, you know, she's so like poor and she's so stupid. Like, how could she possibly have become a healer?
That's rude.
Yeah. A pamphlet published around the time of the North Berwick trials, I think it's published in like 1591, so kind of like in the middle of the trials.
Mm-hmm.
It's called News from Scotland, and I only got partial access to it, but one of the quotes I have is that Galus Duncan took in hand to help all such as were troubled or grieved with any kind of sickness or infirmity, and in short space did perform many matter most miraculous.
Mm.
Yes. So, and it's not like just healing, like it's miraculous healing. Like, she is healing the people who cannot be cured.
Right. Cool.
Yeah. So like, she's really interesting. I don't know why a woman miraculously healing incurable people means that she's a witch.
Yeah, it could kind of go one of two ways.
Yeah, David decides that it means she's a witch. Like, women doing magical stuff back in the day, it's really like a coin flip between saint or burn at the stake. Yep. Or maybe both.
Or maybe both, yeah.
Looking at you, Joan.
At Joan of Arc.
Anyway, it's bullshit that he decides that she's a witch, but it's not the end of the bullshit, because guess what David does when he decides that Gilly must be a witch?
it's not turn her over to the authorities for a trial.
Mm.
If you thought maybe that was the answer.
Yeah.
No, he gets some friends together and they just torture her in private.
No.
Uh-huh.
What the fuck?
Yeah. It's disgusting.
Men.
And it goes into a pretty good amount of detail about what they do to this woman. So they crush her fingers with thumb screws. I think they're also called pillywinks or something. But
fucking screws. British people, why do they do that?
Everything sounds so like a carnival game.
Like cutesy, right?
Like, no, it's fucking thumb screws. Jesus Christ. You put her fingers in the pillywinks. It's like, no. Stop it.
I hate it.
I'm not a fan. Anyway, thumb screws, and they also tighten a rope around her head. And I don't know what exactly this means because this phrasing gets used more than once in this pamphlet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if, like, it doesn't make it sound like it's around the neck. So I don't know where exactly it's being tied, but it's being tied somewhere and it's being tightened.
Right. I watched this documentary about like Mexican prisons, and that's like one of the tortures that they would use was like you get a wet rope and you tie it around a prisoner's head, like their forehead, like a little circlet, and then you just like sit them in the sun and the sun dries the rope and it gets tighter and tighter.
Ouch. So
scary bad.
Yeah, so maybe they were literally just tying it around like their skull and tightening it. I'm sure that that would hurt like a bitch. So.
Yeah, it wouldn't feel nice.
No, I can't say that's what I do on my Saturday afternoons.
You don't self-flagellate?
No, no, I don't. No, this is why I won't be a saint.
That's okay.
They're trying to get her to confess to witchcraft, but she won't do it. They then inspect her for a devil's mark, which wigs me out because I've read about that being done by other women or midwives for like modesty's sake, because they check like everywhere for devil's marks, like your privates and everything.
Oof, yikes.
But it doesn't mention any female inspectors here, so I just don't want to think about what happened.
That's fucked up.
Yeah, they do find a mark on her throat. And once they do, Gilly confesses to witchcraft and to associating with the devil. She goes on to accuse others, and I don't really blame her for that. I mean, she's being tortured by her employer and his friends, maybe in like his fucking basement. Yeah, I don't know.
Probably raped.
Yeah, I would say anything he wanted me to say at this point.
Yeah.
Galus will go on to testify against others and will be executed about a year later on December 4th, 1591.
Jeez.
There's a lot more to her story, but there's a lot of stuff that's interconnected and I couldn't get into it without getting into other stuff that I don't have time for. Because I couldn't read the primary source material of the trial, legal records that do exist, there are still legal records out there for this trial, and I couldn't read News from Scotland, the pamphlet, in full. I'm not sure why, after Galus's confession, that every accused witch is referred to as being like part of the same coven or is this attending the same meetings. I can only assume that that's information she had to have offered up, but that's an assumption on my part. It could have been that someone else that she accused made this accusation at some point that they were all connected, or it could have been a narrative that the authorities started that, oh, we found so many witches in our community, they must be part of the same coven. I don't know. This is the issue with getting information secondhand and like piecemeal. So I'm skipping over most of the people that Gilly accused to hop on over to her pointing the finger at a woman named Euphemy McCalzian, shot in the dark at McCalzian, because nowhere online did it have a pronunciation for that. And there's like four different spellings of that last name, too.
Oh, fun.
Euphemy is also like called Effie, and I like Effie, and it's easier to say than Euphemy, so that's what I'm gonna say.
Mm-hmm.
Effie is in custody and on trial around May/June of 1591. So she's one of the later trials, because like I said, they started in like November of 1590. So this is many months in. I'm skipping over to Effie because Effie is interesting, but there's also a very obvious conspiracy that's going on behind her accusation. Mm. So, Effie is born the illegitimate child of Lord Cliftonhall, but is quickly legitimized by him. Very quickly. Good for her, because her father is wealthy, he is influential, and he has no other children, which means she is the sole heir.
Nice.
Effie will grow up to marry a man named Patrick, who is also from a wealthy family, and in a total power move, he is forced to take her last name, which I love. Nice. Yeah, I don't know if her family was like slightly more wealthy, and her dad's like, you know, as part of this marriage agreement, since I didn't have sons, like, your husband has to change his last name, because I'll be damned if my last name is not living on.
Yeah. Which it seems like it's not, because you couldn't find a pronunciation guide.
No.
That's funny.
I don't know if that has anything to do with the fact, though, that like Effie is the sole heir. She gets accused of witchcraft. And I mean, you can probably anticipate what's going to happen at the end of her story.
Right.
Who knows? Anywho, Effie and Patrick are not a happy couple, probably not helped by Effie trying to murder Patrick inside the first year of their marriage.
Relatable.
Multiple times.
Oh my God.
She attempts to poison him, but it doesn't work. And the literature says that like he's like so young that like he can fight off like any of the illness. Like he can just get through it in a way like an elderly person would have like succumbed to it. But like I said, it doesn't work. And he's just like, you know what? I'm going to go chill out in France for a while away from you, because you're just a really intolerable wife. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just a marital spat. Like, it's not like she's poisoning him. He's just like, I just think we need some space to reassess.
We need to cool off. We need to reflect. I'm going to go to France. You stay here with all your poisons.
Yeah, but he does come back from France, and Effie immediately tries to poison him again.
I love her.
She is determined.
Look, she has goals.
She just wants to be a rich widow. That's it. Yeah,
with a cardigan.
Yep, just leave her and her house alone.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I would assume over like the years of their marriage, Effie is trying to bang this engaged man that she's like obsessed with, but he's not interested at all.
Oh my God, she is a train wreck.
No, it gets worse.
Oh boy.
She tries sending him gifts to like win him over. But when that doesn't win him over, she pivots and instead tells his fiance not to marry him because he has an STD.
Oh my God.
Surprisingly, this also does not win him over.
Yeah, that's kind of
could have anticipated
a weird tactic, but okay.
I'm just gonna go around telling people you have an STD until I'm your only option.
Oof.
Anyway, Effie ends up pretty wealthy when her father finally kicks the bucket. She gets his estate, but this pisses off her family, who wanted his estate and felt that they had a better claim to it. I think it was her uncle in particular, her father's brother, that's like, what the fuck? Like, why is your daughter getting everything you own?
Right, this fucking psychopath.
He's trying to poison her husband. Mm-hmm. They do not get her estate, and I think the local authorities even got grabby with her properties, and she was fighting them in court too. I ran across it this morning, so I didn't have time to verify it. But I ran across a source that mentioned that the local authorities had like taken over one of her properties that she wasn't staying at and used it as like a hospital. And she got really pissed off about it because they didn't ask. She's like, give me my shit back.
Fair.
So yeah, everybody's kind of grabby with wanting her stuff. What happens when you have a woman who people don't like, who has stuff people want? Yeah, it's not going to end well. This is a very bad recipe. But why it's interesting that her name is brought up by Galus Duncan, of all people, is that Effie's husband's sister's husband, and this sounds confusing, so her husband's sister and her husband.
Got it.
That husband is Gilly's employer, David Sutton. So, yeah, David and Effie's spouses are siblings.
Got it. That is complicated.
Yeah, it's a little wonky. I mentioned his financial difficulties, and how that like owes to like his hysteria about witches. Well, when David and Effie's mother-in-law dies, she leaves way more money to Effie and her husband, who are already rich, than to David and his wife, who are struggling. So it's kind of funny. Effie gets accused by the servant of David, who is tortured to tell him what he wants to hear.
Right. That is funny.
Yeah. Is it a coincidence?
Could be. Probably not.
No. And it's not a coincidence. Gilly testifies much, much, much later. I think it's like at the end of 1591, after many people are dead, like right when she's going to be executed. She says the things that she did because David made her say those things. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. He very much wanted things from people and used her to get those things.
Gross.
Yeah, I'm not his biggest fan.
No.
Several people, including Gilly, testify that Effie has gone to witch meetings and that she held a wax figure of King James and insinuated the Earl of Bothwell would be their new king. Like, hint, hint. King James is going to kick the bucket and he's going to be replaced by this guy. And I'm not going to get into the whole Earl of Bothwell thing in this episode, but there is a whole thread in the North Berwick trials about this man. And that was the cousin at the beginning who was left in charge while James was gone.
Yeah.
He is like a running thread throughout the trial. He's very important. I just don't have time to get into him.
Okay.
But the fact that like she says he's gonna be the next king, not good. Not good at all.
Okay, so because it makes people suspicious of him.
That and people already have suspicions about him.
Oh. Okay.
And I think it's his uncle or something that's also like a suspect in like the murder of like James's father or something. Oh. So like there's just a lot of shady shit going on in the family.
Family drama. Who doesn't have
family
it?
Family drama. To spoil it though, the Earl of Bothwell is one of the people who ends up getting kind of accused and implicated in all of this.
Okay.
And so anybody associated with him, not good.
Yeah.
Also a sidebar, Effie has connections to a woman named Agnes Sampson, and she is another accused witch that I'm not going to get into today, but who is extremely important to this set of trials.
Okay.
Her story is just really, really long and really connected to a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. Stories are very long. Effie is found guilty on multiple charges and tries to get a stay of execution by claiming to be pregnant. But either she wasn't pregnant or they didn't care or they didn't believe her, because 10 days after her sentence on June 25th, 1591, she is burned, and she is burned alive at that, which is very uncommon.
Yeah.
Now, hopping back in time to December of 1590, another person accused in the North Berwick trials by Gilly, but also by others, is a man named John Cunningham or Dr. Fian. And that is another shot in the dark pronunciation that I can't find record of that being like a name or a surname or anything anywhere. So okay. We're just going to say Fian. And if you don't like it, K kiss my ass.
Whoa, okay. Confrontational.
People need to start putting pronunciations for shit online. Like, I understand that this stuff is like 400 years old, but like, throw me a goddamn bone.
And you know that there are like medievalists out there, people who have studied this time who know exactly how to pronounce it. They're just not doing their job.
This is not an obscure trial. Like, right. There are multiple like faculties at universities that have articles about it on their websites and mm-hmm. stuff. It's like, none of you thought to put anywhere any pronunciations for anything. Stop gatekeeping knowledge. I just want to know.
Yeah, and also, let's take back the means of production. Am I right, ladies?
Let's just overthrow the system.
I hope we see that happen in our lifetime. Anywho, this is our communist podcast.
It just seeps in sometimes. Mm-hmm. John Cunningham, or Dr. Fian, is a school teacher. He is also the alleged head of this coven that apparently exists.
Okay.
Importantly, according to a source, the good doctor has been in a long-standing dispute with, you guessed it, David Sutton, magistrate, Galus's employer.
I'm over him.
Yeah, another total coincidence. I am positive. The good doctor is subjected to the worst fucking torture. Like, it's so bad. They bind his head again with rope and twist it, like I mentioned, with Galus. They strap his legs into the boot, which I talked about back with, was it Urbain Grandier?
Yeah. The guy with the semen.
The guy with the semen. Semen loopholes. If you want a really like in-depth description of like what the boot is, how it works, somebody semen tortured with it. and also some semen on the side.
A side of semen.
Do I have the episode recommendation for you? Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to get into what the boot is, but like I talked about it a long time ago. So they strap his legs into the boot and they crush like the shit out of his legs and his feet. He waves them down after a couple of good crushes. I'm assuming using like charades to tell them he wants to confess, because it says that like he can't speak. Like for some reason he magically can't speak. I don't know how that went. He had to have done some sort of sign language to him. Some sort of frantic waving of his hands, gesturing to himself.
Right.
He's like, three words.
They're like really focusing. They're like, okay, three words. First word, I don't get it. Is anybody getting this?
Is it a movie?
Is it a film? Is it a novel? Is it a video phrase? Game? Right.
Yeah, so game of charades, because for some reason he can't speak, and those torturing him find underneath his tongue charmed pins, which are what is keeping him from speaking.
What?
Yeah, it's very strange. I don't know why he has pins underneath his tongue. I don't know who put them there. I don't mm-hmm. know if he put them there, if somebody else put them there. But once they are removed, the good doctor is brought before King James to confess.
Okay.
It is hard for me to pinpoint exactly when King James got involved, like who specifically he got involved with or why specifically he got involved with it. I'm not going to get horribly into his involvement today, but he definitely knew the trials were happening, and he's mentioned questioning a few of the accused. He's definitely really involved, like, as we get much further into things. But like I said before, the trials have nothing to do with him to start out with. Mm-hmm. The things that people are being accused of have nothing to do with, like, the storms on the sea. It's down the line that witches start confessing to crimes or getting accused of crimes related to those sea storms. Like Effie, she kind of gets tied up into that whole kind of like regicide kind of thing. Not, mm-hmm. I don't think specifically the sea storms, but like the whole wax figure of King yeah. James and everything. I don't know when that turn happens. I don't know why that turn happens, why all this local witch trial, everybody just starts like confessing to like attempted assassination of the king.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually the trials do start to center around that, and James does take the assassination attempts seriously, and he does become directly involved in what's going on because of that.
Okay.
So, anyway, it is for King James that the good doctor confesses, and there's one story that comes up in News from Scotland about him that I find amusing, but remember that pamphlets tend to be embellished, so take the story with a grain of salt, because I don't think it appears in the official court records at all. The story goes that he had been infatuated with the sister of one of his students, mm-hmm. and thought, apparently, the best way to win her over was with a love spell.
Oh, boy.
He asks his student to gather three of his sister's pubic hairs for him for the spell.
Oh, boy.
Under threat of beating the student. The boy agrees. According to the story, as if the pubic hairs were not weird enough, he shares a bed with his sister. So he waits for her to go to sleep and then tries to steal her pubic hair.
Sure. We've all done it. Look.
Yes. But she wakes up and yells for their mom. Fair. As one does when they wake up to their brother stealing their pubic hair.
Fair reaction.
What do you even tell your mom in that situation?
Here's the thing. This is why I need my own room. Can't do this anymore.
Can you just get us two beds?
At the very least. Just make me a little cot on the floor or whatever the fuck.
Or tell Tyler to stop being so fucking weird.
Tyler, what if his name was Tyler?
He feels like a Tyler to me.
Or a Kyle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Their mother, as it happens, is a witch, and has like this plot in mind. And so she gives her son hair cut from the udder of a cow and tells him to give it to his teacher and say that it's his sister's hair.
Okay.
Sorry, somebody's honking. Dr. Fian believes him, casts the spell on the hair, and then this cow that the hair was cut from shows up totally in love with the school teacher and follows him everywhere.
Oh, that's kind of cute.
Yeah, and the town is like laughing at him because a cow's in love with him.
It's like a Hermione Granger Polyjuice potion situation.
Yeah, but the moral of the story is don't steal people's pubic hair, or I guess a cow will fall in love with you or something, which is oddly specific.
What if I want a cow to fall in love with me?
Then well, you know how to do it.
A long roundabout way.
it really lays it out here for you. Like, what more could you want, Sarah?
True.
Perfect directions.
I thought you said perfect erections. And I was like, I mean, that seems like a sidebar, but okay.
I would never put the word perfect near the word erection.
What about when discussing architecture?
I do find it funny when they say erection in regards to architecture, though, because when I was a kid, it's like you look around like, did everybody else hear what they just said?
I still think yeah. that's hilarious.
Or like when you're reading Sherlock Holmes and it's like he ejaculated and it's like just whoa. They said.
Please just say said.
Yeah, the first time I ever read that, I had already read like Clive Barker and stuff at this point. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, he did what?
Wait, this wasn't in the spark notes. Why is he ejaculating on this corpse? No, that's a Clive Barker moment.
Yes. Anywho, after all of his confessing, the good doctor is returned to his cell. He rebukes Satan and tells everyone that Satan came to him in the night and he renounced Satan to Satan's face. So he's like, you know what? Like, I'm really good now. I'm a good Christian. Like, Satan came to me and I said, like, no, it's not for me, not anymore.
No, thank you, Satan.
Nope. Get out of here. Hit the road, Jack.
Hit the road, Jack, Satan. That's hilarious.
But then he really screws the pooch. Because he steals a key from a guard after he does this, escapes, and is quickly caught, at which point he seems to take back, like, all of his confessions.
Oh, boy.
Which, dumb move, you pubic hair stealing bitch. Like, what the fuck?
He's got a lot going on.
He was so close. Mm-hmm. And then he screwed himself.
Mm-hmm.
They torture the good doctor again, this time ripping off his fingernails with pincers.
Sure.
Love it. And they strap him into the boot again. Apparently they didn't crush his legs good enough the first time because he escaped on them.
I know. Like, what were they even doing? They had it on, like, the lowest setting or whatever.
I don't know. But they just fractured it. He, like, drug himself out of there.
Ooh.
Like, maybe he army crawled. I don't know. Maybe that's why he didn't get far.
Could be. That's gruesome. I don't
know. But this time they crush his legs and feet to the point that they can no longer be used at all. And I would guess he would be permanently crippled had he not been found guilty and sentenced to execution. Mm-hmm. So the source I read says some of the charges that John Cunningham, the doctor, is found guilty of are for having had knowledge that Queen Anne's ship was going to leak in its travels, and, like, he didn't tell anybody. He is accused of having caused storms on the sea, so he does get directly accused of being involved in the sea storms. He's also accused of having dismembered the corpses of unbaptized babies.
Oh my God.
It doesn't say, like, from cemeteries. The sources I had didn't say from cemeteries, but that's mm-hmm. where my mind went, because that's usually what it is in other stories. Like, they're usually already dead and they're in the cemetery and they just dig them up.
For, like, are they saying he did it as part of, like, a witchcraft ritual type thing?
Yeah, usually they, like, use their bones and stuff to, like, make things in other stories.
They grind their bones to make bread. Or whatever, yeah. Shrek did.
For the most part, what I've read about, whenever they dig up corpses and stuff, they're using parts of them to make things.
Gross.
Yeah. The good doctor says at his execution site that he is not guilty of witchcraft. He maintains his innocence, though he does randomly confess to 32 counts of adultery while he's at it.
Oh, wow. Okay. He's like, I really need to get this off my chest. It has nothing to do with this trial, but...
Yeah, since Your Honor, here. I have no pact with the devil. I'm just a horny bitch.
I have fucked everybody in town, including you, Your Honor.
I have fucked so many people.
Mm-hmm.
So many.
The judge is like, weird flex, but okay.
It's like, this is not why we're here.
It's like, not relevant.
At this point they should have had, like, a competency trial. Like, can we even execute this man? Does he know what's going on?
Right.
Does he know why he's here?
Right.
Anywho, he is strangled and then burned, unlike Effie, who was burned alive. And this is either on the 26th of December 1590 or in late January 1591. The records disagree. I didn't write it down, but I think it's news from Scotland that places his death in late January. But there is like an execution expense report that dates his execution as the 26th of December.
So I have that exact same thing in my notes too. And I think it's because the Gregorian calendar was, like, just very recently introduced.
Yeah. It is a little wonky.
Yeah.
So.
It's cool though to see that, like to watch it, the change, like, taking place
mm-hmm.
between, like, so, the dates and stuff.
I'm more inclined to believe like the execution expense record, but like if you do look up News from Scotland, which is like the most prominent like source out there, you're gonna see that January 1591. So as I've kind of said this a million times, skipped around awkwardly through it, saying that I didn't get hardcore into the accusations that sit around the sea storms and James the First. I wanted to do that today, but I just last night as I was writing things, it was getting really, really, really long, so some of the people that I am going to save for kind of a North Berwick part two at some point in the future, get into this again, are Agnes Sampson, who I mentioned. There is a magician named Richie Graham. There's the Earl of Bothwell. I'll talk about how he's involved in everything. There's a man named Robert Grierson and a woman named Barbara Napier. So all of them are like part of the regicide story, but they're really, really long stories. They're so long. There's so many details to their stories and they share a lot of characters, which is why whenever I started writing everything down, it's like, I had to pick and choose, because it's like, well, if I mention them, then I have to mention these three people. And if I mention this person, I have to mention those four people. And that's one of the reasons that I cut out parts of Galus's story, because she's connected to a couple of these people. And if I got into them, I would have to get into the rest. So whenever I do eventually come back and I talk about these people, you will get more of like Galus's story and a couple of these other people. Another reason I chopped it in half is just the North Berwick trials. We have a dozen plot threads, and I was getting overloaded researching, trying to keep it straight, because they all like inter-accuse each other. It's this group of people, and like one of them will accuse four of them, and this one will accuse two of the others, and that person will accuse like five of the others. And it's just, it's this web. It's just a mess.
Sticky.
This, though, covers three of the main victims of the North Berwick witch trials, trials in which an estimated 70 to 200 people were accused in total, and we don't really have an idea of how many of them died. It's probably a safe bet that most of them were tortured, though. But here you are, half a story. Ta-da.
It was good. I don't think I will ever forget the pubic hair and the cow that fell in love.
The pubic hair and the cow that fell in love as a children's book pictures.
Oh my god. Disgusting. That would fuck you up as a child reading that book. Yeah. I'm writing that down. The pubic hair and the cow that fell in love. Aw.
It's so sweet. You can go right next to like Everybody Poops and then that dinosaur book where like all his friends die. What is it called?
Oh, all my friends are dead, I think.
I think it would go nicely with those two.
That was good.
Do my best.
Okay, today we actually have a bit in common. We are definitely in like the exact same time period, same monarch, or on the same page. So today I'm going to talk about the Scottish Reformation, which began in 1560. It was a long drawn out process because it required the breaking of old alliances, the overthrow of a monarch, and some convenient political maneuvering by Queen Elizabeth I and our favorite king, King James. Our saint that we're framing the episode around is named John Ogilvy. He's the only post-Reformation Scottish saint. Most of their saints are like way, way old, and there's not even that many of them. So he's the only one that's after the Reformation. And he was a Jesuit who returned to his homeland of Scotland on a mission to minister to the few remaining secret Catholics during the Counter-Reformation. The main pattern that I noticed when I was doing my research was the idea of two different narratives of the same situation. On one hand, the Catholic perspective of these events particularly the Jesuit perspective, would be this like heroic narrative of bringing the old faith back to Scotland after it's been outlawed, like a very nostalgic view of the way that things used to be. On the other hand, the other point of view, the Protestant or nationalist view of these events would be that these priests are like sneaking around illegally. They're trying to persuade the king's subjects to undermine his authority and pledge their allegiance to the Pope instead. So same situation, two very different perspectives. So I'm going to try to keep the background information like simple, because it does get complicated in a way that I don't pretend to understand completely. there are whole books about this event and this period of time. So basically, this is what happened during the Scottish Reformation. Step one, Scotland from the year 1542 was under the control of Mary, Queen of Scots, who was a Catholic, but at the time she was just an infant, so it was controlled by a lot of regents.
I'm sorry, I don't know why that made me laugh. Like Catholic or infant, those are the options.
She was a Catholic, then she became an infant, and then she converted
back.
Yep. The only two options, Catholic or infant. Yet another unrealistic goal for women. See, these are the things where like you're doing your research and you're like, oh, this will be funny. But then you don't anticipate the stuff that just like comes out naturally that you weren't even thinking about.
Me thinking you were going to say Protestant and you said infant. My brain halted on the tracks.
You're like the math lady meme.
This math ain't mathin'.
That's funny. So she was an infant who was also Catholic. There were Protestants living in Scotland at the time that she was the ruler, and Protestant literature was being circulated, but any like outspoken Protestant leaders were being executed, which of course only inflamed like other Protestants for the cause. In 1546, a group of Protestants seized St. Andrew's Castle, assassinated the archbishop, and held the castle for an entire year before they were defeated, which is like
a really intense game of capture the flag
for real. Also known as kill the archbishop. That's what they call it in Scotland.
Well, you guys take it way more seriously than we do here.
Jesus, calm down.
Calm down. Take it down a notch.
One of the survivors, so one of the people who had captured the castle and survived sort of like the aftermath of it, was a chaplain named John Knox, which is probably a familiar name. He would go on to be the founder of the Presbyterian Church in Scotland.
Those goddamn Presbyterians.
I know. Well, today we're going to get into what the heck they're all about.
Today we finally uncover what is a Presbyterian.
And it turns out I'm still not really sure. Well, so it can refer to simply a system of organization, or it can refer, if it's capitalized, it can refer to a religion, specifically like the religion of Scotland after the Reformation, 'cause that's where the Presbyterian Church was founded. By John Knox. So while John Knox was in exile after killing the archbishop, whatever, he went to Geneva, where he developed his Calvinist religious ideas and eventually returned to Scotland in the year 1559, right as things were really heating up. While he had been in exile, the French-Scottish alliance had collapsed. There was an alliance because Mary, Queen of Scots, had married Francis II of France, and one of their moms was the regent of Scotland at the time. So they had a Scottish-French alliance, but that's gone now. And Elizabeth I of England had like swooped in after the destruction of that alliance and the tide had completely turned in favor of Protestantism. So John Knox comes back and immediately becomes the superintendent of the Scottish Reformation Parliament. It was made up of only Protestants, and they were all named John.
Oh, yay.
I wish I was kidding.
The Council of Johns.
Yes, clearly a representative sample of the people. Just landowning white Protestant men named John. It's like a joke. Like, this has to be a joke, but it's not. It's history. One of the Johns was named John Spottiswood. He is important to our story, so he will come back. In 1560, the Reformation Parliament passed the Papal Jurisdiction Act, which abolished the supremacy of the Catholic Church in Scotland. They also drafted a new Protestant Confession of Faith, or Creed, called the Scots Confession. Queen Mary refused to approve it, so it wasn't officially legal until she was overthrown in 1567. So for a few years there, the question of, like, church government was completely up in the air, because Presbyterianism and Catholicism have very different ideas about how things should be structured. Catholicism is obviously very hierarchical, and there are lots of intermediaries at every level, all the way to the Pope.
Whenever you get into, like, the supernaturally stuff, like, you've got the saints, and then you've got Jesus, and then you've got, like, it's just always a hierarchy of things.
Well, it's kind of that, like, Aristotle great chain of being situation. Mm-hmm. It's like mirroring that. But Presbyterianism is much more like a republic than a monarchy. It's like made up of these representative assemblies of elders instead of like a bishop. Yeah, so Parliament wants to reform the church government, but they can't do anything because Mary won't ratify the new act. That is, until she's overthrown and her son, James, takes over. This is the James that we are not the biggest fans of. Like you said, he's James the VI of Scotland, who also becomes James the I of England in 1603. James was raised Protestant, but he wasn't a fan of Presbyterian structure. He was worried that it wasn't going to help him consolidate his authority. And that was the ultimate goal of his entire monarchy. He wanted to be in charge of everything and everyone that he could. So throughout the course
No way, James.
You're talking about the James who, like, murdered witches with his own hands? No way. He didn't actually do that. That was an exaggeration. So throughout the course of his reign, he guided Scotland into a form of church government that had Protestant or Reformed ideals, but an episcopal hierarchy. So he slowly reintroduced positions for bishops and archbishops that only he could appoint. And by the time he died, Scotland once again had a full panel of bishops and archbishops, and assemblies could only convene under James's permission and supervision. Okay, enough about that guy. Our saint, John Ogilvie, was born in 1579. He was the son of Walter Ogilvie, who was a respected Calvinist nobleman who owned the estate of, I'm just going to go for it. He owned the estate of Drumnakeith, which is in the northeastern part of Scotland, which is apparently, because I looked it up, I look all the places up on Google Maps. Apparently this is like right in the area where there's like tons of like the famous whiskey distilleries. So I would very much like to visit. So historically, northeast Scotland, this region had been like an ancient Catholic stronghold. These estates and like the Catholic nobility that had been passed down since like St. Columba's missions. John's mother, Agnes, had been a Catholic, and two of her brothers were Jesuits, but she died when John was only three, so he was raised a Calvinist. When he was 12, his father kicked him out, sent him on his merry way to the continent to be educated, because they're very proper. I don't know what that accent was. He sent him to be educated at the Protestant University of Helmstedt in Germany. While John was there, he witnessed a lot of debates between Catholic and Protestant students. This is like right in the heart of the Reformation, and it's in Germany, like where it all started. So at first, obviously, he was on the side of the Calvinists. That's how he was raised. But after doing a lot of his own scriptural research, he decided to become Catholic.
Then he comes home and he's like, surprise, I'm Catholic now.
Surprise, bitch. And his dad's like, I hate my entire life. I don't think this is sad, but I don't think he ever sees his dad again after he leaves the house at 12.
Aw.
Yeah. In the decades leading up to John Ogilvie's education, Queen Mary of Scotland had established several Catholic colleges in continental Europe, specifically for Scottish exiles called Scots Colleges. To quote the papal bull that had approved them, the schools were established, quote, to educate young Scots in good morals, piety, sound doctrine, and Christian virtues. So they weren't initially intended to become seminaries. They were just like schools to help exiled Scots retain their Scottishness. But they did eventually become Scotland's default seminaries, and they were used to educate Scottish priests who intended to return to Scotland as missionaries. So in 1596, John Ogilvie converted to Catholicism, and in 1599, he joined the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuit order, in Brno in Moravia. The Jesuits were the most powerful religious order of the Counter-Reformation. They really led the way in terms of like missionary work and evangelization. John desperately wanted to go on a mission to Scotland. He felt that it was his calling to return to his homeland and minister to the few remaining Catholics there so that Catholicism didn't completely die out in Scotland. I read something like the estimates of how many priests there were in Scotland around this time were like, 5 to 7. It's like, Jesus, for the whole country. It reminds me of Chattanooga. Okay, so he wants to go to Scotland. The general of his order, so like his superior or whatever, is like, just wait, you need to finish your education, you need to be ordained a priest, like, calm down. So in 1610, he was ordained in Paris, and his first assignment was in Rouen. He kept on requesting to be sent to Scotland. Nobody would listen to him. His plan, his like master plan, was that when he got back to Scotland, he would approach some of the nobles that he'd known like in his childhood, family friends that he knew were like secret Catholics, and he would celebrate mass in their homes and then go on from there. That's his plan. He was assigned to London and then to Paris. And then finally in 1613, he got his approval to go to Scotland. He entered the country under the name of John Watson. Again, they're like, the authorities at the border or whatever, like, wait.
Hey, is it John? Let him through.
I was going to be like, oh, isn't that name like from this one book I read? That guy in London who writes all those books, John Watson, sounds familiar.
Or John, is apparently, what, like a surgeon here?
Right. Well, he claimed to be a horse trader. So his master plan, the one where all his old money, family, friends are going to protect him, most of them said, no, thanks. they either had converted while he was gone, because he was gone for like 21 years, or they just didn't want to take the risk. Because here's the thing, while John was gone, King James had sort of like doubled down on punishments for anyone who undermined his authority in any way, no matter what their religion was. So even if you're like a Presbyterian and you're like, I think the king sucks, like, that is treason.
It's like, how fucking dare you?
He's very insecure. Listen, don't even look at him the wrong way. So that would be treason. But also, if you're a Catholic harboring a priest, that is treason, obviously. And we will take your title from you and your land and maybe kill you. Like, those are the threats, basically. But trials of those kinds were relatively rare. James didn't want to fan the flames of a religious war by making Catholics into martyrs, and he liked the hierarchical structure that centuries of Catholicism had established in Scotland. So he didn't mess with the old noble Catholic families too much. It was this like fragile understanding that the nobles didn't really want to push and like see what happened. So most of them did not let John preach in their homes, but some did. So the more devout Catholics who had been like missing a priest for like decades, they were willing to take the risk. So he spent about a year preaching in these private homes from Leith, where his ship had landed, to Edinburgh, and finally to Glasgow. He arrived in Glasgow on October 3rd, 1614, because he had received word that there were five Scotsmen there who wanted to convert to Catholicism, but it was a trap. He had been set up by a parliamentary spy, and he was arrested under the orders of John Spottiswood, one of those Johns of the Parliament.
Of the Council of Johns.
one of the many Johns on the Council of Johns, yes. John Spottiswood at this time was the Archbishop of St. Andrews, which made him the primate of all Scotland, the monkey of all Scotland. I know that humans are primates too. Look, I get that. But that's not that's not where my mind goes. My mind goes gorilla. Okay. So here's where Here's where we see the two main narratives of this case. Both accounts end up being circulated in the following years and decades. So on the one hand, we have John Ogilvy keeping a journal while he's in prison. That's our main source. And then our other main source is John Spottiswood, who wrote a pamphlet about the trial proceedings. These two sources are very different accounts in terms of thematic material. From Ogilvy's point of view, he is fulfilling his ultimate role as a Jesuit missionary, and he is being tortured and put to death for his religion. That is his POV. For Spottiswood, he is upholding the authority of King James by eliminating a traitor, particularly a Jesuit traitor, and this is shortly after the gunpowder plot, which only happened like 10 years before. Those guys were Jesuits, so we don't like them in this country. So each one thinks that he's the hero of the story. And we see the divergence between the two narratives right away, because John Ogilvy's version, which is entitled Relatio Incarcerationis et Martyrii, is written in Latin, obviously. And the full title mentions that he's a Jesuit. The introduction is a letter to the superior of his order, and he opens the narrative with, "May the peace of Christ be with you." Also, the dates, like I said, in Ogilvy's version, used the Gregorian calendar, which had just recently been sanctioned by Pope Gregory XIII in 1582. Scotland would not officially adopt the Gregorian calendar until 1752. So obviously, the first big difference with John Spottiswood's account is that he uses the older Julian calendar. Also, obviously, his account is written in English and not Latin. It's entitled... This is one of those paragraph titles.
Why did they do it?
A true relation of the proceedings against John Ogilvy, a Jesuit, executed at Glasgow the last of February, anno 1615, containing sundry speeches uttered by him at his arraignment and others that assisted the commissioners deputed for his trial with all that passed at his execution.
It's like they put the abstract their work as the title. Yes. Here's absolutely everything that my entire work contains.
The end. Goodbye. long ass title. So Spottiswood's account begins with a letter to the reader that's supposed to explain why John Ogilvy was executed. The framing that he does of the execution is that John Ogilvy was executed not for his religion, but for his unwillingness to declare King James's authority and supremacy, which of course for any Scot would be high treason. So that's the frame we're supposed to accept, because King James doesn't want Catholics thinking that this guy is a martyr. And like James's mother was a Catholic. His wife was probably Catholic, at least later in her life. And again, we like the structure, but we can't have anybody undermining the idea that James is like the end all be all authority of Scotland. But Spottiswood sometimes gets confused. And I mean, he will occasionally use certain words or phrases or go on little tangents that like betray what he really thinks about John Ogilvy and the Jesuit order and Catholicism. And the pamphlet is like not very long, and this happens a lot. So it becomes clear that the issue of authority and supremacy can't be separated from the issue of religion in the way that James wants it to be separate. So for example, on the very first page, we have a little preamble that addresses the reader and basically says like, "Hi reader, it's me, John, Archbishop, et cetera, et cetera, King James's favorite. It has come to my attention that hoes have been gossiping about that guy that we killed, saying he's a martyr, whatever. Here's the real story. I will give you the inside scoop and I'll tell you why he really died. Spoiler alert, it wasn't for his religion." But he says that he's writing it to, quote, "obviate the misreports of the enemies of true religion, who wrest and draw all things without respect of truth to their own advantage." So he immediately admits that it is, like, at least in part, about religion. And then he goes on a whole tangent to remind us that Jesuits are the worst. He's like, "Remember the gunpowder plot? Those guys were Jesuits. They tried to kill our king, and then we executed them. And then the Catholics went and put them in their Book of Martyrs." And it's true, like at this time, there was this race between Catholics and Protestants to become martyrs. And of course, the martyrs on one side are the traitors on the other side. Like, it's a mess.
Catholics are like, "We can out-martyr you any day."
Well, I mean, they do have a much longer tradition of martyrs. So he continues his introduction and basically says, "Look, King James didn't want to kill this guy. He brought it on himself. And we've been so nice to traitors. Like, we've banished a ton of them instead of murdering them. Like, we're good people." And he ends the intro with a warning to all the other secret Catholics of Scotland. He says, quote, "And here to all our Catholics in this kingdom, if nothing further may be obtained, and that still they will lie in that superstition wherein they have been nuzzled, I wish at least so much wisdom to beware of Jesuits' policies and not to think their practices the cause of the Catholic Church. It is not religion, as one hath well observed, that they strive for, but sovereignty. It will not content them to have the Romish faith and ceremonies embraced. The crowns of kings, their scepters and subjects must all be at the Pope's devotion." So by this logic, he says you can't be both a true Catholic and a true Scot. Not possible. So now we get into the trial proceedings. The court alleges that John Ogilvy came to Scotland under an alias and describes the circumstances of his arrest. The items that were found with him were priest type things, chalices, relics, including a lock of hair of St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order. That doesn't look great. Why would you have that?
I'm holding it for a friend.
Yeah, that's not mine. Like, it's drugs, but it's a little baggie of hairs.
I don't know how that got in my things, officer.
I've never seen it before. I've never smoked hair before. What am I talking about? Okay, so he confesses that his real name is John Ogilvy and that he is a Jesuit priest who was sent to Scotland. He is then asked to take an oath in which he promises to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, blah, blah, blah. He responds that he will take an oath, but with some exceptions. He says that he will refuse to answer questions that could endanger his life or the lives of others. And the court's like, "Nah, beans, that won't help us."
That was the whole thing we were after.
What if they were like, "Oh, okay, well, have a nice day then." We did our best. I feel like that would be like a Canadian trial.
It would also be me as an employee of anything.
Right. Be like, "Oh, can he do that?
He'd be like, I'm going to be difficult. And I'd be like, okay, then I'm just going to whatever.
Oh, then I don't even care anymore. You're like playing hard to get. You're like, I didn't even care what you had to say anyway.
They don't pay me enough to care.
Exactly. So they're like at a standstill. And finally, John Ogilvy says, I swear to tell the truth in whatever questions I choose to answer. So like, take it or leave it. That's all you get from me. So they take it and they ask, why did you come to Scotland? To which he answers, I came to save souls. They ask him when he came, he tells them. But when they start talking about masses and places that he stayed, he stops answering because he doesn't want to incriminate anybody else. And so, quote, the lords, thus finding him obstinate, returned him to a cell in the castle where he remained until the 8th of December. So a couple months. During those few months, he is visited by many different ministers who attempt to engage him in scriptural and theological debates. Spottiswood refers to him as choleric during these debates, which I'm sure I would also be rather choleric too, after spending like being in prison for months with dudes trying to like debate with me all the time. That is my actual nightmare. In Ogilvy's account, he writes down what they debated with him while he was imprisoned, which took a lot of fucking Google translating because there's no ebook of the English version. So I was like squinting at
Welcome
the screen.
Welcome to my world.
Oh, it's so annoying. I need to learn Latin. I need to just fucking learn Latin. What am I doing?
Yeah. I mean, it would probably help me too.
Yeah. What am I saying? Okay, so he says that the three main points of difference between them in these debates were the celebration and the validity of mass, the papal succession, and the authority of the person who was to judge controversial religious cases. And within Ogilvy's account, in several different places, he writes that he is willing and ready to die for his beliefs in these controversial topics. At one point, Ogilvy recalls a discussion with Spottiswood in which Spottiswood tells him, hey, this weird thing that you have about dying for your religion, that comes from a place of passion instead of reason, and it's unnatural. To which Ogilvy responds, actually, I'm speaking from my own reason. I'm capable of rational thought, and this is what I want. So on the 12th of December, he was presented at Edinburgh for another trial before the Lords and the King's Attorney General. Spottiswood says that he was super rude and unreasonable in refusing to answer any perfectly reasonable questions that they asked him. And of course, they're like asking him questions so that they can kill him. Ogilvy was warned that the next step would be torture. And he said, you gotta do what you gotta do. That's a real quote from this 17th century text. It's crazy. And Spottiswood writes, quote, and here it being remembered that in the trial of some criminal persons, it was found that nothing helped more to find out the truth of the faults wherewith they were charged than the withholding of their natural rest. It was advised that he should be kept without sleep for some nights, which was accordingly done. I think I read that he was kept without food and sleep for 9 nights, after which the trial reconvened. This time
he was hallucinating wildly.
He was tripping balls. He was out of his goddamn mind. how is that legal? And so the trial reconvened right when he's on the brink of complete insanity. And this time, this session, they have been sent questions by King James. That's what Spottiswood says. Who knows if King James even cared at all about this trial? So these were the questions. Question one, we want to know whether the Pope is judge and has spiritual power over the king, and whether this spiritual power extends into the temporal. Question two, we want to know whether the Pope has the power to excommunicate kings, including James. Question three, we want to know whether the Pope has the power to then depose the excommunicated kings, including James. And then four, we want to know whether a deposed and excommunicated king can be rightfully executed as a heretic, because that was something that had been sort of like brought into the public sphere as a topic of discussion at this time. If the king's deposed and excommunicated, can he be tried as a heretic and executed?
I feel like they could have asked literally any Catholic this, like any of them.
Yeah, and it's clear that they're making an example of this guy. He's like the perfect candidate to use in this very like public trial, and then to kill him and say that he's wrong. But then on the other side, for the Catholics, he's also the perfect guy because like he's a hero. And it's proving how like cruel the punishments are. I don't know. It's interesting. So those are the questions, and here are his answers. He says, yes, the Pope is the spiritual judge of all Christian kings, including James. He says he is not qualified to answer whether the spiritual power extends into the temporal, because he leaves that up to the judge of all religious controversies, whom he acknowledges to be the Pope. And he says, yes, the Pope has the power to excommunicate kings, including James, because the Pope has the power to excommunicate any baptized Christian. When he is asked if the Pope has the power to depose James and whether that means that James can lawfully be executed, he says that he doesn't know. And again, he would leave that in the hands of the judge, meaning the Pope. The man who's questioning him asks if he would like to lock in his answers. Reminding him basically that anything he said can be used against him. And he asks if he'll sign his name to what he said, to which John responds, yes, I will claim those answers as my own. And by the way, good secretary, please make sure to make a note that says that I said, fuck you and fuck the oath of supremacy. Like, he specifically says, make a note that I am against this. So they're like, all righty, John, just as a recap, you are not being tried for being Catholic or saying mass or possessing relics or anything. You are being tried for refusing to take the oath of supremacy. And if you apologize really nicely, I'll tell the king to take it easy on you. And John is like, that's so sweet of you, but I have to pass. So he goes back to his cell. Again, people come visit him, try to talk him out of it. He's okay with his choices. Also, he's hallucinating like crazy, and so he's not really sure where the people are.
They're all giant talking spiders.
Right. Not sure which ones are real and which ones are actually just spiders. At his arraignment, the indictment against him is read. Then he is allowed to speak for himself. And he basically says, I shouldn't be tried for treason because the laws of this country are decided by a tiny group of men who don't represent the people. So I don't give a shit about your laws. He actually says, I will not give a rotten fig about the laws, which I actually like.
It sounds like my grandpa cursing. I don't give a rotten fig.
And he says, as for the accusation that I'm undermining the king's authority, the king has no authority besides the authority given to him by his predecessors who were subjects of the Pope. If the king only claims to be the king, then I will acknowledge him as king. But if he keeps on saying that he's the spiritual authority, then I won't acknowledge him as anything. He actually says, I won't even acknowledge him so much as this old hat. So he has like quite a bit of an attitude. He's kind of spicy.
Your king is equivalent to my old hat.
And they're like, he is out of his mind right now.
He's like, just ranting and raving, wandering around the room.
You're like, he's not even wearing a hat. Oh my God. He like thinks he has a whole like really big hat on, like a top hat. No, that's silly. So the trial continues and he gets a chance to speak for himself before the jury. This is kind of like his little statement. He says, quote, I wish the gentlemen to consider well what they do. I cannot be tried nor judged by them. And whatsoever I suffer here, it is by way of injury and not of judgment. I am accused of treason, but have done none offense. Neither will I beg mercy. Spottiswood replies, like, basically, how can you say you've done nothing wrong? You came here with a purpose of perverting the king's subjects, etc. And Ogilvy says, quote, I came by commandment, and even were I now fourth of the kingdom, I should return. Neither do I repent anything, but that I have not been so busy as I should in that which you call perverting. I hope to come to Glasgow again and to do more good. If all the hairs of my head were priests, they should all come into the kingdom. So he's like, this hair is a priest. This hair is a priest.
They're like, this They're like guy. He is officially off his rocker. He has lost his marbles.
They're like, can we kill him yet? Jesus Christ.
He's talking about his hair being priest now.
Just like complete sleep deprivation. They basically ask him one more time about the issue of deposing the king, and whether executing an excommunicated king would be murder. And he says, quote, I refused before to answer such questions because in answering, I should acknowledge you judges in controversies of religion, which I do not. I will not cast holy things to dogs. And so we move on to the sentencing portion.
They're like, I've heard enough.
His friends in the audience are like... The jury unanimously found him guilty on all charges, and he was sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. At that point, he asked if he could have permission to speak, and it was granted, and he said, quote, God have mercy upon me. If there be here any hidden Catholics, let them pray for me, but the prayers of heretics I will not have. So, attitude to the end. John Ogilvy's execution took place on March 10th, 1615 at Glasgow Cross, which is like an intersection right in the heart of the city. So very, very public. And again, March 10th is the Gregorian date, which is why in Spottiswood's version, he says it took place on the last day of February. In the description of the execution, that divergence between the two narratives is like definitely apparent. Ogilvy's version was finished by witnesses of his execution. And the way they describe him is very different than the way Spottiswood describes him. Spottiswood said he's like weak and feeble and he's stumbling to get up the stairs and he's like shaking like a leaf and his voice is too quiet to even hear what he was saying. Whatever nonsense he was saying, couldn't even hear it because he's like a little mouse. He's crying, like he makes him look really pathetic. He even says that his left foot stayed on the ladder, quote, like that of a man unwilling to die. So he's like trying to invalidate that desire for martyrdom, trying to say like, oh, well, in the end, he was scared. So he really didn't want to die for his faith or whatever. But the witnesses are like, yeah, he was like gaunt because he'd been starving, but he like pulled himself together. He was brave. And before he died, he kissed the hangman. Which is crazy. Like he was like on drugs or something.
He just laid one on him.
Everybody was super confused. It was kind of sweet, but kind of weird, you know.
Like, you know what? If you're gonna kill me, might as well do this while I'm at it.
It's like I've always wanted to do this. This is my last chance. No. And he said Mary, Mother of Mercy, pray for me. All the angels pray for me. All you saints pray for me. Again, he said that in Latin. So then John Ogilvy was hanged and drawn. They did not carry out the quartering. I don't know why. It could be that to show King James is merciful. I'm not sure. So they disemboweled him, but they didn't have the horses pull his body apart. So fun times. He was buried in a secret plot and his body was never recovered. So we have no relics. He was only 36, pretty young. I don't want to die when I'm 36. In the year following his death, his relatio was printed at the Jesuit College in France and it was circulated in England and Scotland, which is like what prompted John Spottiswood to publish his own account. Like, here's what really happened. From 1886 to 1929, many martyrs of the Counter-Reformation were beatified. These were known as the 40 Martyrs of England and Wales. That's their official name. Margaret Clitheroe is one of them. But the church in Scotland declined to include John Ogilvy on that list because they wanted to keep him separate from the others and to honor him as their specific Scottish saint. Again, that attempt to preserve the inherent Scottishness, which is why those Scots colleges were founded in the first place. There's like a resistance to being subsumed by Britain that I think is cool.
I think they have a right to not want to be subsumed by Britain.
Yeah.
Britain that subsumes everything it can get its hands on.
Mm-hmm. The morning and the evening star, or whatever their slogan was. So he was beatified separately from the 40 martyrs in 1929. He was canonized in 1976, and his feast day is March 10th. And that is John Ogilvie, the only Scottish martyr.
I like his attitude.
Me too.
I love spiteful people like that. This is one of the reasons I liked Effie in my story, who tries to like poison her husband and shit. But yeah, I love people who are just like, fuck you. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to do what I want. Screw what you want.
Yeah. They're like, we'll kill you. It's like, I dare you. I wish you would.
I'm going to go to heaven.
Right. Oh, darn. Eternal glory. That sucks.
Scotland. Aye.
Is that what they say?
I don't know. I know that we'll be back here in the future, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you said that you have older saints.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, pre-congregation saints. Like, the earliest would probably be St. Columba, but there's a ton, like, in that, like, cluster when there were all those, like, monasteries in Scotland. So there's more. There's just no really, like, recent ones. He would be the most recent.
I know I'll be back for the rest of the North Berwick witches at some point and their stories. And I mean, this is kind of the years where the witch trials cluster. I don't know if I'll end up talking about other Scottish witches. I've mentioned the Bute witches vaguely back when I talked about Isabel and, you know, the great Scottish witch hunts, which just... Great British baking show.
Great Scottish witch hunt. But Paul Hollywood is still the host. and Noel Fielding.
Yeah.
Paul Hollywood is the Inquisitor.
It's just too cheery.
And Noel is the executioner. Did you know that Noel Fielding plays the executioner in the show Disenchantment, the animated show?
Mm-mm.
I love that man. I would die for him. I don't know him. I don't know that much about him even, but I would die for him. That was weird.
Well, at least you know where you stand and what you live and die for.
Mm-hmm.
For John, it was Christ. For Sarah.
Noel Fielding. Well, he's, for me, it's old Greg. I would die for old Greg. And I do. I admire old Greg, and I hope to be like him one day.
Martyred for old Greg.
That's my legacy.
Oh, that was fun.
That was a weird turn at the end there, but yeah.
We got there. I think we landed it. Kinda. Maybe.
Yeah, I think we're done here. Thanks so much for listening, especially Scotland and especially Spain, the newcomers. Is there anything
else?
You
know how to get a hold of us on our various platforms. You know, we put pictures up on Instagram, so look out for those. I know that I've got some photos of the News from Scotland pamphlet, so you can see how ridiculously hard it is to fucking read. So I've got that. Who knows what Sarah will throw up on Instagram.
Ugh.
If you guys have any recommendations, let us know, because we did get a request for
an episode. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's what I was forgetting.
Yeah, we got an episode request. So that is like on the docket. That is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for Baba Yaga to be featured. And we'll see what I end up talking about in conjunction with Baba Yaga and what Sarah can match to that. So
that's like a Russian thing, right?
It's definitely like that area. I might get into more of like the hag mythology in general,
mm-hmm.
or even like folk tales, children's folk tales and stuff. So we'll figure out some way to broaden it and to connect it.
Yeah. Cool. I'm excited.
Yeah. Unless you've got like a saint with chicken legs or something just hanging around.
There probably is one. I bet there's a patron saint of chickens in particular.
We just really tangentially connect.
The thematic connection, and the theme is chicken.
You figure it out.
Yeah, you figure it out. That's our motto.
Anyway, look forward to that. Look forward to a special Q&A episode that Sarah and I are prepping. Where I'm going to ask her questions I have about Catholicism, and she's going to ask me questions she still has about witchcraft, and we're going to see what happens.
My first question is, how dare you? Who do you think you are?
Well, that was my first question for you.
Well, we are on the same page. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks be to God.
Blessed be.